DevOps. Auf die Ohren und ins Hirn. Ein Podcast rund um DevOps.
Von Dirk Söllner, Falco Werner und Luca Ingerni.
Welcome to a new episode of DevOps auf die Ohren und ins Hirn. Or in English, DevOps from your ears straight to your brain. Usually this is a German language podcast, but we sometimes make exceptions for international guests. Today is one such exception. My name is Luca Ingerni and I host this podcast together with my colleagues Dirk Söllner and Falco Werner. We're DevOps consultants, trainers and coaches trying to get teams to work together better and create better products for their customers. And today we are joined by a very wonderful guest, Isaac Perez, the head of infrastructure at Fresher. Isaac, very welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Luca and Falco.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Isaac. What do you do for a living?
I lead the infrastructure teams at Fresher, which is a beauty and wellness platform. It's actually two-sided. We have the marketplace where you can book your appointment in a hair salon or nails or a massage or spa. And we have the business management platform that allows those businesses to do everything that they need to run their business, manage the rotation of the staff, sell products, marketing campaigns, book appointments, take payments, and anything that you need, really. The main areas of the teams that I lead, which are part of the platform organization, are focused on cloud infrastructure, so traditional where you run your workloads, for us, AWS and EKS, mainly. And the other parts are deployment pipelines and developer experience, so how we can get that software development cycle shorter and have a better user experience for our internal users. My background is in systems administration, data center operations, then DevOps, then platforms. So it's kind of the evolution of the space as it went through the years.
Yes, and the topic that we have picked for today is infrastructure strategy, isn't it?
Yes.
So this is something that I'm very curious about, how to sort of deliberately create a strategy to evolve your infrastructure and the people operating it, as opposed to being stuck in a reactive mode and sort of trying to muddle through. Okay, but before we dive into the topic, we have a tradition on this podcast for every guest to give us their definition of DevOps. So Isaac, what's your definition?
That's an interesting one, because it seems that everyone has a different definition and and a different implementation. To me, I started seeing it from one point, which was bringing software development practices to operations teams. Traditionally, operations teams were at most scripting and not necessarily like having a software lifecycle for their tooling, like not treating their services, their outputs as a real service where you have to test it, deploy it. So that was the initial part. But then I realized that it has another component, which is before, like many years ago, like development teams would throw things over the wall, as we say, and operations teams would have to run and deploy the changes or the new features that the software delivery teams did. But that was the usual complaint. But I also realized that operations teams used to do the same. So we used to build a tool, whatever we wanted, and then tell all developers, now you use this. Like, we don't care what you think. We don't care about the user experience. You're just going to use it. And that caused frictions both ways. So I think DevOps is bringing two walls like closer together, in the sense that operations do more software development, lifecycle, more agile and more user experience. But at the same time, development teams also learn how to run their services. They own them now. In theory, they own it, or they should own them. They got better at productionizing those services and maintaining them and making them like operationally excellent, which was not something that software product teams were good at or were focused, not good. It's like it was not one of the goals for them. It was just ship features. And now it seems that both walls like got a bit of each other. And to me, that's a better come than.
Okay. And where is testing in this?
That's a good question. To me, testing, I see it as a kind of a platform offering. So the platform team should provide the tools to do testing. like tooling services, like build a framework, and the software teams should do the testing because they know that their software better. So I think they should be able to run, create better tests, and it goes earlier in the cycle, but with the with some help, because the testing mentality is a bit different from software mentality. When they test a lot, think about edge cases and load and all that. But I still think it's better if most of the testing happens early in the cycle, like TDD, and done by software engineers with the help of some either coaching and tooling and platform services provided by really real experts. Also, it doesn't scale if it's not distributed. You cannot have like one tester or one QA or a team that ends being the bottleneck for everything that's deployed. That reduces, makes the deployment times or the cycle times
and
much,
what is
much longer.
After operations, is there something that you need to consider in the value stream that's after the operations teams or the infrastructure?
That's a good question. I would say the product team, right? After that, you need to ensure that the features that you delivered, well, there's two dimensions of this at least. One is that the features actually produced an outcome from the business, that they're not, I don't know, we just shipped a feature, doesn't provide anything. And then that you can continuously maintain and evolve that feature. So one would be more technical in the terms of like, can we maintain, can we evolve this feature? Do we have the metrics to know from an operational point of view that's working well? But also, do we have the metrics to know that from a business point of view, it's working well, it's worth keeping, is it worth the cost?
How's your connection to the customer then?
My connection to the customer, it depends. These are another interesting question, because usually I have a very personal distinction between users and customers. To me, you in the platform world where I sit in infrastructure or DevOps or platform, users are usually software engineers who use the tools that we build. But they're not our customers because they don't pay our salaries. Our customers are the end customers that buy the products that the company sell. And at the end of the day, those are the important ones. So our users who are software engineers are just a proxy to reach the customers. Sometimes, most times, they both align. So we create better pipelines, better developer experience, so we can get more features out and more stable features out to the customers. But sometimes we may do some security work that actually hinders a bit the developers, but it's to protect the customers. Maybe we do some high availability work that hinders the developers but protects the customers. So at the end of the day, the customers, the ones who pay, are the ones we serve. And most of the time we do it through our users who are the software engineers.
All right. So maybe now is a good time to switch gears and take a step back and set the stage for what we want to talk about, which is infrastructure strategy, right? Why do we need that? And did we have that before? And what does it look like? What did it look like? I mean, you spoke in the introduction a bit about this separation between dev and ops, you know, the famous wall of confusion. Was that part of a strategy or was that just an accident?
That probably was a result of the environment. I wouldn't call it an accident or strategy. I'm pretty sure it was not part of a strategy, because when you think about it, it seems a pretty bad strategy to have. It's like, let's get operations and developers not talking to each other so they cannot work together and we like release worse features less often. So that as a strategy seems something no one will come out with, but that was the result. So I think it was product of the time where Agile was probably still coming. Well, it didn't even exist before. It was very waterfalls of planning, and you had two different sections, and they had their different waterfall processes. And Agile started catching up, but operations was behind. So I think that the strategy was always there. It just didn't caught up with the times or with the modern practices. And people at the strategic level were not thinking, updating their way of thinking about the strategy, a way of thinking about technology or engineering in a modern way. They were just the old waterfall process. This is my turf. This is your turf. Don't touch it. We'll talk at the end kind of thing. And I think it makes sense from the point of view that strategies are usually created by senior people who most of the time are older and they're set in their ways. And well, I'm saying that I'm not that young, but I think that because they were created by an older generation, it took some time until the new generation who were more in agile and had a more open mind, at least to that point, started creating the strategies themselves. And they realized, okay, this doesn't make sense. We're going to get better outcomes if we work together. And then it started being part of the new class of strategies, if you want, of the new strategies that were being created.
Okay, so now we do need a strategy. What's the point of this strategy? What are the cornerstones of the strategy? What does the strategy aim at versus what maybe does it explicitly say this is out of scope for me?
Yeah, that's the always problematic point when you start a strategy. Like, what do you want the strategy to do? What is this strategy for? And I think this is where hard for business leaders or like engineering leaders, especially in infrastructure, you're quite removed from the business. And sometimes we forget about the business part and we just like, we need to use Kubernetes or we need to use like, and really no one cares if you use Kubernetes or not. Like you think like the hair salons care if we run in AWS and Kubernetes. No, they don't. They care about the reliability of the product, how fast the features are arriving at their terminals, at their like phones. So the strategy should really understand what is the problem we're going to solve for the business. It can be a technological problem, but it has to help the business. And where was the environment? So I would not do, and I certainly did different strategy in smaller startups than a scale up like Freshia. They're different than bigger companies I work for, like Thomson Reuters. We have like 5,000 people in the business unit that I was working in. And so the strategy not only has to take into account the problems that you want to solve for the business, not for technology itself, but also the environment where it works. Not the same. It's a highly regulated industry. It is not. It's like, it doesn't matter if you lose the data for like 1 hour. It's like, those kind of things should guide the strategy too.
Okay, so what is the point of the strategy? What is the goal of such a strategy? Or what happens if you don't have such a strategy?
So, okay, those two different, let me see if I can split them. The goal of the strategy, it has to be to help the business reach its goals. So let's say that you're in growth mode, like hyper growth mode, and you need more users per month, more active users per month, which is usually like a common goal for growth companies. Then how do you get those users? And how do you get and how do you lose these users? Something I like from system thinking is when you have a stock, you can fill, let's say you have a bathtub, you fill water and you have the drain. So you can, to fill the bathtub, you can put more water faster than it drains or stop the drain. So when you have more active users, I say you want more active users, you get new users, but users leave. More users, let's say that you need more features. And users leaving is because the platform is not stable. So they get frustrated and they leave. So simple examples. And what we can do as a strategy from infrastructure in that sense would be, let's work on having deployments to production faster or shorten feedback loops for developers. Those two common things that are usually painful and people always want deployment from you can make a change to it's running in production faster. So you could work on that. Or you could say, actually, we're losing lots of users because the platform is really unstable and we have to do some work on stabilizing it. And that's more important than shipping more features at this point in time. We can say short-term strategy, fixing the stability so we don't lose users. And long-term strategy, we want to create more features once that's the stability, it's at a good level.
Okay, well, that still sounds quite like a product strategy, not so much an infrastructure strategy, right?
Yeah, but that's the funny thing is like we should treat infrastructure as a product. We should not do it on our own. Well, at least I believe so. So our strategy for infrastructure should not be that different from the product strategy. Just what changes is how we implement it. So, for example, a product strategy could be we're going to release this new feature that allows you to book appointments in, I don't know, from your phone, because we couldn't do that before, what's on the website. And from the infrastructure side, we could say we need to create a deployment pipeline for mobile phones because we didn't have one before. And it took 3 days or 5 days to like build, compile, and publish and everything. So our strategy for the infrastructure will support that business goal just in another way. And maybe it's to get you an example, give you an example, a bit more infrastructure. One project that we're working on at the moment, it's migrating from Jenkins and other deployment tools to Argo workflows. Why do we think that's important to do? I think because they develop these two areas, more dimensions to this one, but two important ones are developer experience and development experience. So the experience the developers have on using the deployment pipelines, which we think it's going to be much better in Argo workflows, and our own experience development pipelines, which is going to be much, much faster than doing it in Jenkins because it's much easier to work with, it's like easier to test, all that. So the way that we can help the business strategy would be like long-term, we migrate to a cloud-native workflow engine that will be able to be cost-effective, much faster to work with, and much faster to develop with.
But that still sounds kind of reactive to me, right? You're listening for complaints from the developers, which is a good thing, don't get me wrong, but it's not proactive, is it? You're just waiting for what gets the most complaints and then you go and fix it.
Yes and no. We, for example, you could, if you only listen to the complaints, you will have fixed Jenkins, for example, in this particular case. But I think the strategy part comes to seeing the problem is having better deployment pipelines and then thinking, okay, we move to cloud native tooling or we're still moving to cloud native tooling. Jenkins, for example, is like out 2 generations older. We want something that's cloud native for these reasons, which is like cost effectiveness, easy to work with, easy to support because we already have a lot of experience in Kubernetes and this works in Kubernetes. So I think it's a bit more, it's listening to those complaints, but also at the same time, you're evolving your platform towards like a future that it's more, aligns more with. So you're evolving the platform towards a more flexible and maintainable solution that will allow you to move faster in the future. Now, maybe you're asking something that we've done without listening to user complaints first. And that's, I have another example of, we started using Backstage.
What's Backstage? I've never heard of that.
Okay, that internal development platform, it was created internally for Spotify created it. They open source it. And it's kind of becoming the standard open source internal development platform. And we started using Kit because we thought, we know we have some pain points like finding your services. We started migrating to microservices and now we have like about 80 between monolith and microservices. And it's very difficult to create a new one. And it's very difficult to find the services who owns them. We have like spreadsheets and like you have to go through the code. So Backstage solves that problem. Plus it's another tool that once we have like a foot in the tool, it will allow us to provide a lot more visibility and capabilities. And that came partially from pains from developers, but it was, okay, we see internal development platforms are going to be important in the future, so we want to invest in it, and we started using Kit. And that's kind of stepping stone into really being a platform team, a platform organization, instead of the traditional infrastructure where we build something and you use it.
Interesting. Yes, thank you. That was a very good example. But it brings me to something else that has been bothering me, which is that you yourself said that the beauticians or whoever use your platform don't actually care whether you're using Backstage or Kubernetes or any of these fancy things. So, I mean, and I agree that this is probably valuable, but how can you show business impact? How can you show value for such invisible work?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it comes all to, from my point of view, metrics that the business cares about. So, for example, for Backstage, one of the metrics that we want to improve is onboarding. So let's say that you hire 50 developers in a year, and instead of onboarding them for 4 weeks, you onboard them for 2 weeks because they find all the documentation. That's 50 per 2 weeks, you gain 100 weeks of productivity per year. So that's very easy to show to the business, like we added 100 weeks of productivity to the engineering team. And the same with daily tasks. It's not that easy. It's not that easy to say we gain like 2 days more or something like that. But we can have metrics like, even if it's user surveys, like how long did it take you to find a service that you need to work with, the documentation, the owners. So before, maybe it took like a couple of hours before you start working on a ticket. Now it takes 5 minutes. So those are the metrics that you can use to show impact. And in Backstage, most metrics are related to how long did it take to do something for a developer before versus now. Another good example, we're pushing towards migrating to microservices and extracting from the monolith, which is a very new problem no one else had before. And that was a joke. I thought you guys would kidding. So this creating a new service is like not easy unless you have the tooling. But when the first thing we did with Backstage was use service template. So you click, and before it took you 2 weeks to create a new service, literally. Now it takes you, I think now is a couple of hours. It's not zero time, but you went from 2 weeks. So let's say that you plan this new feature. We need a new service because we want to migrate to microservices and that has all their benefits. We plan 4 weeks or like 6 weeks because the first two we had to like, we didn't have the service. Now those 2 weeks are gone. Just like, yeah, we'll do it. It's just 2 hours. So we don't even need to count that much for it. So you're shortening the migration out of the monolith, which brings or cascading effects or faster development, but you're removing essentially 2 weeks of work each time that you do this. And I think those are the metrics that the business cares about. And you have to show them not, oh, we have Backstage, it's super cool. You have to tell them, look, before it took 2 weeks to create a service, now it takes 2 hours. And maybe in a month, if we want to invest more, it'll take zero because everything will be automated. Not only that, the service will come with 90% production, what we consider production ready, which is another month of work that developers have to do.
That brings me to an interesting question that I've been pondering while you were talking, which is, would specific technologies actually be part of such a strategy formulation? Like, would it be part of your strategy to say, we will introduce Backstage, or will the strategy formulation be on a higher level where we say, oh, we need to find ways to shorten the setup time for a new service or something like that?
Yeah, I would not include the technologies themselves in the strategy. And that's something that I've also been thinking about because there is so many different technologies and it changes so fast that let's say that you do the strategy for this year and you say, oh, we need an internal development platform because that's going to solve these and problems. And for some reason, you instead of started in January, you start in June. I would not put my name in a technology at this cutting edge in January, like it will be the same as in June. For this, for others, like let's say that you're going to migrate to a cloud provider from your data center. Yeah, that there I think the technology should be there. You should decide which cloud provider, how are you going to use it. For that one, it needs to be there, the technology. For strategies of we're going to improve developer experience by the end of the year, which is something we want to do. And part of it is we want to integrate better with the IDE. I would not say we're going to, from day zero, we're going to integrate with Visual Studio Code, VS Code or anything like that. I would say we want to integrate better with IDEs. We'll do a phase of research of which ones are the most used and well-received and people are keen to using, switching to if they're not using it now, and then we'll decide. So the important part for this strategy is integrating better with the IDE, not which IDE. For big migrations, yeah, if you're going to migrate from MySQL to Postgres for whatever reason, you need to choose the technology.
Okay, but so at what point do you make those tooling decisions, and who does them? Will that be the same person or same group of persons that does the strategy formulation, or do you just give like teams, internal dev teams or user-facing dev teams free rein and say, oh yeah, you know, as part of this strategy, we're going to reintroduce Jenkins because we love Jenkins for some misguided reason. How does that work?
Yeah, again, I like to think about this, making those decisions as the waterline in boats. If you have a decision that's going to make a hole under the waterline, you really need a really good decision. If it's above the waterline, it's okay, you recover. So for smaller decisions, less involvement from leadership. For bigger decisions, more involvement. And an example would be when we were choosing migrating from current tooling to Argo workflows. I was involved as part of at the leadership level, I just set some constraints. For example, I wanted to be cloud native so we can optimize the costs later on. So we want to run it in Kubernetes because optimize the costs. We have a lot of experience running in Kubernetes. It integrates with everything else we do. And that was my level of involvement. I really didn't care if it was Argo workflows, or it was Jenkins X, or it was another tool. I think giving the freedom to the tech leads to decide those things, it has more benefits than leadership dictating we're moving to tool X. Again, if it's migrating the company fresh migrated out of Heroku, at that point, choosing the cloud provider, I think it has to be approved by the CTO because very big implications involving everyone, but it has cost implications. It's many, many implications. So I think that should be done, at least involve the CTO, and the CTO is the one to approve, and probably CFO and other business parts. If it's lower tooling, like moving to EKS, moving to Kubernetes, using or not Kubernetes, probably is also a big decision. So it has to involve get input from everyone, but at VP or CTO level, because it will shape how you work in the future, in a big way. But some tooling Backstage and all that, but the problem is there's not that many options for Backstage. It's kind of the only one. So that's the decision is made for you. But if there were two or three contestants, I think that could be more of a conversation.
Okay, but that in turn means that even if you only delegate decisions above the waterline, that still puts a lot of responsibility onto individual teams, doesn't it? What goes into enabling teams to take on that responsibility effectively and safely?
There's two ways to think about this, at least. One, or several dimensions. One is making sure that there is a safe environment where people can make mistakes and we learn from them. So you won't be blaming publicly people for making mistakes, but you work with them to make sure that we learn, that everyone learns from the decision. And it depends on the level of competency too. It's when you delegate, you don't delegate the same to all individuals. Some individuals have much better, different skills than others, so you can delegate some tasks. So you have to ensure that the teams have the skills and the knowledge and experience to make that decisions. To make the decision, so you can either train them or hire, coach them to get to the level to make that decision. Then it goes above the waterline. But you also need to make sure that it's presented as an opportunity to learn, not if you don't get this right, we'll fire you kind of thing. Yeah, which that no one will make decisions or will all end using IBM. I guess the old famous quote, no one gets fired from choosing IBM. So you have to allow a bit of experimentation and making sure, yeah, it's okay. We made a mistake. We'll learn from it.
So it sounds like even that should also be part of your strategy of building this kind of culture to enabling the teams in terms of, I don't know, skills and organization. Wouldn't that be right?
Yes, I think that's right. You plan the strategy, you take in all those components. And I think that's, now that you mention it, it comes into the environment that you do the strategy for. Because when you do the strategy, you do it to solve some problems, but you have the constraints of the environment that you build the strategy for. And that part of that environment is empowering teams to make decisions if that's the strategy they want to follow. Maybe you don't want to follow that strategy and you are like a top-down approach, which may work in some environments or some under some circumstances. But yeah, making part of the strategy is like we will kind of hand over this decision-making part to the teams so they come with the decision because we want to empower them and they will be more engaged if we do that. So it's definitely part of the strategy.
Are there common best practices for infrastructure strategies to be aware of or some way where you can borrow some ideas and not have to start off from scratch or from iterating based on what works and what don't work? Because strategy is usually a long-term thing that you take into account, so it's probably good to have some starting point.
Yeah, I think there are definitely best practices where there's getting a bit of a bad reputation now for some reason, but they are best practices that I think you can start to get it. You can help you to guide your strategy, let's say, because I'm more familiar with AWS, the only cloud I use professionally, but you have AWS best practices and CIS, the Center for Internet Security benchmarks. So you could say, I don't think anyone would say we want to make our platform less secure, but let's say that you say, okay, part of the strategy this year is we need to ensure that the platform is secure. And that's kind of no-brainer in the sense of saying it, but what's the strategy? So you could say, we're going to use CIS benchmarks for AWS, and we are going to use AWS best practices and the white papers that they have. And that will help you the strategy. I think the problem is that there is no best practice to actually build a strategy. There is a lot of noise and there is some good practices. You have some good books, but there is no strategy, at least that I know of, like a template strategy for infrastructure. There are some things that are almost always true. Like you want better development experience. You want faster development cycles. You want more reliable software. But it's always a balance. So sometimes you may want a lot more reliable software than developer experience, or a lot more secure software than developer experience, or speed of feature delivery. So I think those are business specific. You can see what other companies at similar stage and similar size have done for guidance. But unfortunately, I don't think there is like a template for a strategy sell because it's so context dependent and so business dependent that it's very hard. For thinking about a strategy, I like William Larson has a good post that maybe I can share and add to the show notes.
And we put that in the show notes. Thank you.
And the book Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. That is kind of a Bible for strategy from Richard Rommel. That one's a good read, but it will tell you how to build a strategy, not a specific strategy for infrastructure or technology or anything. It's like kind of how do you know if this is a good strategy or it's not a good strategy and what are the parts?
Yeah, I was just wondering if there is some good starting points. Thanks for providing those two ideas or resources. And obviously you have to decide based on your organization's situation. Do you have or do you really need new developers? Then it might be valuable to prioritize developer needs, maybe even before the customer. If the customer base is broad and evolving and word spreads from mouth to mouth, then it's probably not that important to, if you're providing very good value, it's not that important to increase customer need or to focus on customer needs. So from that point of view, yeah, I agree, that's situational wise.
Since we were talking about people, would such a platform strategy also reach as far as reorganizing parts or even all of your organization?
Yeah, totally. I think that has to be, well, totally. In my current role, for example, it would totally be part of the strategy, and it is part of the strategy. So when we think about the strategy, for example, we want to focus a lot on developer experience this year. So one of the things we want to do to achieve that excellent developer experience will be creating a developer experience team and splitting the two teams I lead into three teams. One would be developer experience, because I think it makes extremely clear what's the importance of that team, what are the goals, and what's the focus. If you have it in the same team, it's really easy to, is it easy to get distracted by everything and shifting priorities? But if you say, no, developer experience team, your only goal is to make developer experience better, then the question is, which developer experience am I making better? Not if I need to upgrade EKS or I need to stabilize the platform. So I think for bigger organizations, it has to be part of the strategy most of the time. On the other side, because I have a lot of experience on smaller organizations, it doesn't make that much sense because you don't have that much to reshape. So, for example, the first DevOps strategy that I did, the team was me and someone else. So much you can do with two people, right? So, yeah, it's, again, context dependent, but in bigger organizations, it should be part to ensure that you put the resources and the capacity where they should be to achieve your goals. In smaller organizations, maybe you can play a bit with it, but it will be very hard.
Yeah, but you keep talking about this topic of distractions. Maybe you can speak some more about that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest problems that I see for achieving your strategy is distractions in two sense. There are, and this is something I think a lot about as a leader, and I tell my teams, even like, if I'm distracting you, tell me to fuck off and don't come back until I finish my current task. And I think there are two kinds of distractions, the important ones that you should consider. For example, we're working on the longer term project or migrating to Argo workflows, but the stability of the deployment pipelines, and that's one of the reasons we want to migrate out of Jenkins and the current setup, it's not great. So sometimes it's like stops working and impacts every deployment. So with that, I did negotiate. I explained to the CTO, like, look, I know we have this longer term project. We have a milestone coming in a month, but I'd like to spend 2-3 weeks stabilizing the platform first, because that's very painful now. So let's move the deadline like a bit further away so we can fix this. So I think those, you still need to account for them. And if you need to change the strategy because some really important thing comes, you have to do it. But there are the small things that are not important, like micro distractions that add up a lot. For example, I ask one of the team members, hey, can you get me this dashboard? Can you get me this metric? Can you get me this, like, I want to change this from P99 to P75 in this dashboard. So there's things that as a manager, we tend to ask very quickly to our reports or the people we lead. And we don't think is, oh, tomorrow I'm going to ask, why didn't you finish this ticket? You said you were going to finish it tomorrow. And then I wasted half of the day of this person asking like stupid things that don't really matter for the goals. So I think it's not easy. Like I still do it and I think about it all the time. So you have to be conscious as a leader of all the questions that you ask and all the interactions that you have with the people who report to you, either directly or indirectly. And you have to provide the safety and empower the teams to say, hey, can I do this tomorrow because I want to finish this? It's very hard. I've been trying. I've been telling the team, seriously, tell me to like leave you alone. And they don't do it that often. So I need to remind them again that they can tell me to this is not important. I want to finish this other thing. But yeah, it's the distractions. The micro distractions are a big problem, even though you think, oh, it's only 5 minutes, but it's 5 minutes like 20 times per week. And the macro distractions that I think you as a leader need to wait, is it important enough to distract us from the strategy or not? And sometimes it will be, the answer will be yes.
Yeah. It's interesting that we keep coming back also to this topic of increasing efficiency and talking about how can we shave off some time. And something that I find quite eye-opening is there's this famous webcomic called XKCD. Maybe you've heard of it. The guy who draws it sometimes has really interesting, not really comics. And one thing he has is like a table where he says, how much time can you afford to invest for a given time savings, yeah, depending on like how often you do an activity? And if, I don't know, if you can save 5 seconds 20 times a day, then it means you can afford to, I can't remember, invest a week of optimization, yeah, effort, and it will, and you will come out ahead in a year's time or 5 years' time. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I was doing the all hands for our engineering. I was presenting part, like I have my section in the all hands for all of our engineering organization last week. And one thing I read in a couple of articles, those micro feedback loops, and they were like 5, 10 seconds, 20 seconds. And part of my presentation was, one was we want to create these DevEx champions kind of role within the teams. And the other one, I told the engineers, like, if you have anything that takes 10, 20 seconds, 1 minute, and you do it often, let us know, because we'll help you like shorten that feedback loop or remove it. And one of the engineers came to me like, I would have never thought of that if you didn't say it. I think people are so used. And I said, yeah, if it's even 10 seconds, if you do it enough times per day, it's worth, and it's not one, it's 100 engineers, 130 that we have. So imagine if it's worth or not. So I think people just don't think about those small like micro feedback loops. And it's just something I brought up and people were surprised, and we're going to start working on them.